He that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. So declared our Lord in that discourse which we've just read together from the 24th chapter of Matthew. He that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. Well, surely nothing could provide a greater stimulus to endurance to the end than the encouragement and the exhortation provided in this same discourse of our Lord. In it, Jesus gives those signs so familiar to all of us, which would herald his return to the earth. And he concludes them by saying, "This generation, that is, the generation witnessing these signs, witnessing the budding of the fig tree, shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled." So let us just think what that means. It means, surely, that our generation will not pass before they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. It means that our generation will not pass before he shall send his angels to gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. How stirring, how sobering it is to reflect on this as we are gathered together in this way once again around these emblems of the sacrifice of our presently absent Lord. Yes, the servants of God have kept this memorial feast in faith for more than 1900 years. They have done it in obedience to our Lord's command. "This do in remembrance of me." And now we stand right at the end of the times of the Gentiles. The times when, at long last, Jerusalem is no longer trodden down by the enemies of God's people. In the very epoch when Christ will be manifested. And it is for this reason that the words of warning which Christ couples with this prophecy are of particular importance to ourselves. Christ knew that in spite of the signs of the times which the Almighty has been pleased to reveal, in spite of the acknowledged nearness of his return, there would be many among those professing his name, an apathy, a lethargy, a stupor, which would numb their senses to the reality of what was about to happen. We suppose we all know how it is. It is difficult for each of us, having waited so long in patient expectation, to believe that our hopes really will soon become accomplished facts. The routine of our existence seems so inexorable, our way of life so set, that it is not at all easy to be fully conscious of the sudden and shattering change which is soon to take place. And so our Lord uses some graphic imagery to bring home to us the reality of these things. He first compares the impact of his coming with that of the flood in the days of Noah. Just as they were then, eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, going about their business and pleasures with no thought of the cataclysm which was about to break. So it would be again. The world at large would be completely absorbed in its own affairs, heedless of the future. Those are the conditions which it is foretold would prevail in the world. But what about his own brothers and sisters? Then shall two be in the field, The one shall be taken and the other left. Two women shall be grinding at the mill. The one shall be taken, the other left. What does that mean? Well, it means that one day, and it may be any day now, as we are working with our colleagues in the office, or at the bench, or perhaps washing up at the kitchen sink, we shall be called away to meet our Master. Yes, quite suddenly, the call will come. There will be no time to delay, no opportunity to prepare. No, we shall be taken by an irresistible power and transported into the presence of our Lord, there to give an account to him of our stewardship. And the verdict which he will then pronounce upon us will depend upon what we are then. There will be no opportunity for a last-minute change of character or conduct. Remember those words in the last chapter of our Bibles, the 22nd chapter of the Apocalypse? The time is at hand. He that is unjust, let him be unjust still. And he which is filthy, let him be filthy still. And he that is righteous, let him be righteous still. And he that is holy, let him be holy still. And behold, I come suddenly, and my reward is with me, to give every man according as his work shall be. So then, the exhortation surely is that we should make sure, in the short time that may be left, that we may be truly described as righteous, as holy, and may thus be filled with joy and gladness, and not with fear and remorse, when the call comes to meet our Lord, as surely it will. Yes, that is the exhortation which our Lord gives in this discourse. It is that we endure to the end. It is that we make sure that we are personally prepared for the coming of our Lord. And how better can we do that on this particular occasion than by using as our guide and our example one of those of whom we are reading at this present time in our daily readings, one who earned the highest approval of the Almighty. "I have found David," God declares, "a man after mine own heart, which shall fulfil all my will." David was a man who foreshadowed in many ways the one whom we have met to remember this morning in these emblems upon the table. He was a man who was proved by the things which he suffered, a man who, being tried in the furnace of affliction, came out as gold tried in the fire, a vessel fit for the high honour which it is God's pleasure to bestow on those who please him. Now David had much in common with ourselves. Although he stood so far removed in point of time from the accomplishment of this hope, while we stand so near, yet he looked for exactly the same things as we do. His faith burned so brightly that these things were just as real to him 3,000 years ago as they are to us in these last days. And it was the fact that these things were to him realities, things he really believed in, which enabled him in all the vicissitude of his life to exhibit those noble characteristics which endeared him to the Almighty. Indeed, his life in all its phases is an exhortation to each one of us, however young or however old we may be. Undoubtedly, the foundation of his godly character was laid in the days of his early youth as a boy in his teens, tending his father's sheep, on the hills of Judea. It was then that David had the opportunity to meditate, to read God's law, to think about the Almighty and his purpose, and what he required of his children. It was here that he developed the taste for divine things, which is so beautifully expressed in the 119th Psalm, where he writes, "O how I love thy law! It is my meditation all the day. How sweet are thy words unto my taste! Yea, sweeter than honey to my mouth. Through thy precepts I get understanding. Therefore I hate every false way." Yes, David, like his greater son, who at the age of 12 revealed his understanding of God's ways, learnt to know his Creator in the days of his youth. And in this, of course, he sets us today a very valuable example. Those who learn the truth in the days of their youth have a great privilege, but they will only reap the full benefit of that privilege if they allow it to sink deeply into their hearts. This means much more than just a knowledge of the principles and the doctrines of the truth. David's strength during his subsequent adversity, and he suffered very much adversity, his strength in that adversity was derived from the fact that he identified himself with God in all that he did. During his formative years, he had learnt from his reading and his meditation the inscrutable wisdom of all God's ways. He had learnt that God's ways are best, whatever man may think, and that the highest good does come from doing what God has commanded, however much appearances may seem to be to the contrary. Well, today, as perhaps never before, young people are encouraged to think for themselves, although, at the same time, they are probably subjected as never before to a barrage of human philosophy and shallow thinking. But those in the truth have at their disposal treasures of wisdom and knowledge undreamt of by those around. Wisdom and knowledge which will dispel their doubts and their misgivings, will fortify them in adversity, will enrich their characters, if they will but draw upon them to the full. And remember, young brethren and sisters, that David was no weakling. He was no dreamer. No, he was a man of immense valour and physical courage. Yet it was a courage and a valour which blended perfectly with, and was indeed generated by, his love for the ways of God. It was not prompted by vainglory, by pride, by love of praise. No, it was based upon an intelligent understanding of Israel's relationship to God, and upon an absolute confidence in God's overruling providence. A confidence expressed in those famous words which he spoke to Goliath. "Thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. This day will the Lord deliver thee into mine hand." Well, that is one facet of David's faith, his supreme confidence in the Almighty. But it is particularly in his adversity that we see fully manifested the fruits of his meditation upon God's law. Here we find, in his adversity, a complete submission to God's will, a full recognition of the wisdom of God's ways, and a magnanimity towards his oppressors which surely can only excite our greatest wonder. His resignation to God's will is beautifully expressed in the 57th Psalm, where he cries, "Be merciful unto me, O God, be merciful unto me, for my soul trusteth in thee. Yea, in the shadow of thy wings will I take my refuge, until these calamities be overpast." Yes, confidence in adversity. And why? Because he believed that what God had promised, he would assuredly fulfill. That was the basis of David's confidence. God had promised him the kingdom, and he knew that it would be his, notwithstanding all appearances to the contrary. It was this same confidence, this same faith, which moved him to those extraordinary acts of magnanimity towards Saul, when twice Saul was put within his power, and he refused to harm him. It is particularly in David's actions and his attitude on these occasions that we see a discernment, a refinement of judgment, which could only come from a very keen perception of the mind of the Almighty. A lesser man would have argued, as indeed those about him did, that this was God's way of fulfilling his promise, and that it was David's duty to take it. But David had learnt the lesson which we all have to learn, and which was so beautifully exemplified in our Lord himself. It is that the honour which God has promised to bestow is not something which we can take for ourselves. It is something to be received from God in God's own good time. Jesus could have yielded to the clamour of the multitude when they wanted to take him and make him a king. But no, he knew that probation is a time of submission, of humiliation, of chastening, and he could afford to be patient. Well, so it is with us now. The honour and the riches of the world are not for us now, although at times they may possibly come within our reach. In due time, God will exalt us, if we faint not. And of course, in due time, David's day of exaltation came. Yes, after many years of wandering and suffering and persecution, he received the kingdom and was elevated to the highest position among God's people. And it was because it had been through this process of suffering and humiliation that he had attained this exaltation, that we find in his prosperity a full flowering of his character. Although he had, as we say, attained the highest position in the land, there was no feeling of pride, none of the lust for power which corrupts so many rulers. No, in prosperity he showed humility, gratitude to God for his goodness towards him. "I will extol thee, O Lord," he sang in the 30th Psalm, "for thou hast lifted me up. O Lord, thou hast brought up my soul from the grave. Sing unto the Lord, O ye saints of his, and give thanks at the remembrance of his holiness. Thou hast turned for me my mourning into dancing. Thou hast put off my sackcloth, and girded me with gladness, to the end that my glory may sing praise to thee. And be not silent, O Lord my God, I will give thanks unto thee for ever." Yes, that was how David expressed his mind after his exaltation to a position of eminence. So David's life, as indeed the lives of all the saints, demonstrates the need for patience. We learn from it the gradualness of divine operations. As we know, he was promised a kingdom right back in the days of his youth, and yet many years went by and much suffering before he received it. At times, events seemed to be going in quite the wrong direction, and without his unshakable faith, he would certainly have despaired completely. Well, let us remember that these are the ways of the Almighty. It was so with the Master himself. It is so with us in these last days. But God's ways, though gradual, are sure. That is the lesson which we can draw from the experiences of David and from the experiences of Christ himself, as represented in these emblems before us. He that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. For as Jesus says later in his discourse, verily I say unto you, that he shall make him ruler over all his goods.